Hello, and welcome to the long-awaited next episode of Oddly Medical. I'm Sarah.
I'm Chrissy.
And today we're going to be talking about hypnosis.
Oh, so me doing the little pendulum with my microphone earlier totally tracks with today.
Yeah, sure. That absolutely.
That makes me excited.
Yeah, you were just it being prescient. Will you stop playing? So as you may have noticed, we took a little bit of a hiatus recently.
Yay, adulting.
Yeah.
It's great.
It's completely my fault. There's been some life things.
Yes, one of us has a job that had fewer people at it, so she was having to work a lot more. Not going to hold that against her.
So, but we're back, and hopefully I am back in the swing of things.
My mic's in the swing of things.
I cannot stand it. She keeps, you know, the little dangly, it's like a screen you'll see
it's
on
the buffer mine? Screen.
Okay, that, whatever.
Ours dangles.
Yes, and now she's playing with it and making it go back and forth, because this
like
is the kind
I'm
of day.
Hypnotizing you.
I just want to throw myself.
Just go with it.
Anyway.
Back on track.
Let's hop into this, shall we? Okay. Hypnosis is defined as a special psychological state with certain physiologic attributes resembling sleep only superficially and marked by a functioning of the individual at a level of awareness other than the ordinary state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It is characterized by a degree of receptiveness and responsiveness in which inner experiential perceptions are given as much significance as is generally given only to external reality. So you are paying attention to what's going on in your brain and your emotions and all of that as much as you normally would external stimuli. It is also characterized by a state susceptible to the suggestions of the hypnotist, even when external stimuli contradicts. So
yeah, like balk like a chicken.
Or you're freezing right now, but the room is, well, the room is like this one.
Can we have them come hypnotize us, please?
We in Texas.
It hot.
In August.
It hot hot. It like, hot, we're hot. Hoping that one of those tropical things hits us next week. Like, come on, we'll take it.
Yeah. So a person needs to be willing and cooperative for hypnosis to work. After induction, i.e. after the state of extreme relaxation, suggestions of increasing individual distortion are given. So, like, your hand is too heavy to lift and things like that.
Yeah. I saw one on America's Got Talent where they hypnotized Howie Mandel, who has, like, touch phobia. He doesn't, and germaphobic.
He's an extreme germaphobe.
And he was shaking hands with everybody on the panel, and they were like, ooh, as they touched his hand. Because, like, nobody's ever touched his hand before.
I bet he lost his mind once he came out of it.
I don't know. I bet when he, like, watched the tape back.
He just like, after, you know, you go through the whole hypnosis thing, they wake you back up, whatever. There is such a thing as post-hypnotic suggestion. So subjects' execution at some later time of instructions and suggestions that were given while in a trance. So, like, every time you hear a car beep, you balk like a chicken, whatever.
I want to do that to somebody.
And with great power comes great responsibility. Don't do
that. I would do it to my son.
That's just funny.
Yeah.
There's also post-hypnotic amnesia. So people are unable to recall events that occurred during deep hypnosis. But this can be removed with the right suggestions.
Really?
It just depends on what the hypnotist kind of plants.
So you're just absolutely jacking up somebody's brain.
You can.
Or hijacking their brain.
You can, yes. This can go off the rails.
I'm
absolutely.
So curious. Like, I don't know if I fully believe in it.
Well, we'll get to how it works and all that in just a little bit, but
yeah. Ooh, you gonna hypnotize me today?
I can.
Put me to sleep right before you go home. That would be great. Please do that. You're gonna sleep well and amazing. You're stupid. Bye, I love you.
But before we get into the science of hypnotism, let's get into the history of hypnotism.
All right, Houdini, let's do it.
Houdini was not a hypnotist.
He was an escape artist. Oh, escape artist.
There are evidence of things called sleep temples in both ancient Greece and Egypt.
Going.
They're seen as healing places, often with rituals involving herbs, prayers, darkened chambers, and rhythmic music. So you're supposed to dream your cure. What you'll notice in a lot of these more way back examples of hypnotism is that people, it was used as a healing tool. And a lot of times you had potions and herbs and things like that for induction, i.e. to get you there. So an inscription was found in Velia, Italy from around 500 BCE that describes healers known as, I know y'all miss me mispronouncing things, Phalarchos, who were in charge of healing, in charge of the healing caves where the sick would lie down and have a healing dream or vision.
That's neat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Around 350 BCE, there was the cult of Asclepius, who is the Greek god of medicine.
Okay.
So
I would have figured it would have been like Tylenol would have been his name or something, you know? Like, because they always derive something from the name that you're like, ah.
No.
But no, there is
stuff in medicine that's attributed to Asclepius, but that's the stuff.
But not that one. But it's not the god of Tylenol. Like,
no, it's not the god of Jeff, the god of biscuits. Like, yeah, no. No.
Yes!
No. So they found 300 temples where visitors entered a state of sleep known as encoimesis and experienced healing dreams under the care of priest physicians. So they functioned as both priests/physicians.
Ooh, that's illegal today.
Yes, because faith healing never happens.
Oh, that's a different way to think of it.
Is it? Is it?
I'm thinking priest, like Catholic.
Nope. And priest back in ancient Greece is a whole
different... I forgot we were in ancient Greece.
Is a whole different animal than...
We are there, aren't we?
Hmm.
With Jeff, the god of biscuits.
Jeff, the god of biscuits. Next we have Avicenna, who I think we've talked about here on here before, but he was a Persian philosopher and physician. He wrote about the characteristics of trance states in the Book of Healing published in 1027.
Whoa. What's crazy is there's even a chance that book is still around, like in those... Where do they keep that stuff nowadays?
Oh, various libraries. You know, you have...
Of course, it's across the pond.
Yeah, you have the Library at the Vatican. You have you have the British... The British Museum has an archive because, you know, colonization.
Of course.
Yeah, no. So yeah, there are archives all over.
Crazy would it be, like, because I've seen them actually pull out letters from like Anne Boleyn and stuff like that, which I just find beyond fascinating.
If you hear something in the background that sounds vaguely obscene, it is actually a 16-ish year old chihuahua who is snoring with his tongue out in the corner.
But you know what? He is so happy. He is comfortable. He's on a very large pillow. He's living
his
best life.
He's on my pillow.
He is on your pillow, but he's snuggled up with you here. He feels your amazing, warming, loving presence, and he's sleeping soundly.
Lord. When we get into the Middle Ages, we get to something called the Royal Touch. Now, this is not a new concept, but it was believed that kings and princes held healing powers, and if they touched you, they could heal whatever. It's a tribute to divine powers. You make a face.
I know.
Pharaohs did this. And, controversial. Jesus did this.
Jesus wasn't a man.
That depends on your belief system.
Well, that's true, because the Jews believe he was a man, right?
I believe he was. Everybody but Christians thinks he was a man.
Well, I only know Christianity. I've never explored other religions. But for me, with the kings and the princes thinking that they have the divine touch, it's just another misogynistic trait.
Well, and again, because they believe they were ordained by God to be rulers. Same as pharaohs, as, again, thank you, that spooky, boring white men that think they're magic.
Yes.
Even though Egyptians not white men.
I was going to say, Egyptians aren't white, but we'll go with it. We can wiggle them in.
Adjacent. Just boring men who think they're magic. How's that? Next we get into Paracelsus, who we have definitely talked about on this podcast before. He was a Swiss physician in the late 1400s, early 1500s, who he was the first person to use magnets for healing instead of divine touch or a holy relic. So there was a, you know, if you touch, you know, St. Bob's knuckle bone, you could get, you know, you could get healed. And that was a very big thing in the Middle Ages. Holy relics was a big deal. And then you had your monarchs. But so Paracelsus comes along and goes, you know, I think we can use magnets for this. Why does this have to do with hypnosis? Well, we'll get there. Next, we have a man named Maximilian Hell.
He was Hell?
Hell, H-E-L-L.
Mr. Hell.
Mr. Hell was actually an 18th century Jesuit priest. So
wait, he's a priest whose name is Max Hell?
Yes.
I love the irony.
Okay, but he was a Jesuit. And so Jesuits are sort of like the special forces of priests. So Jesuits, quick and dirty, they were sort of the elite scholars, but they were also warriors. They were warrior priests. They're who went to the Crusades. They're who did all of that. And they wear dresses. And if I tell you, when we had a substitute teacher that was a Jesuit back in elementary school, that is the most terrifying man in a dress you'll ever meet in your entire life. He was also the royal astronomer in Vienna. So he became famous for using magnetized steel plates on the body for healing. Why he is important is because of his student.
And his name.
His student was a man named Franz Mesmer. Now.
Mesmerize.
Jumping ahead of the game, but yes. Mind blown. All right, so we're going to spend an interesting amount of time talking about this gentleman. So, lived from May 23rd, 1734 to March 5th of 1815. In 1766, he wrote his dissertation for the Vienna School of Medicine and suggested that the gravitational attraction of the planets affected human health by affecting an invisible fluid found in the human body and nature. Now, not a weird concept for that time.
Yeah.
There was and still is.
The full moon.
Exactly.
Yep.
Lunatics, the whole nine yards.
Yep.
So
it tracks-ish.
Okay. So he goes about his business. In 1775, he picks this theory back up. So he had a practice. Like, he went on, he became a doctor, regular doctor. All right. So in 1775, he picks this back up, and he revised his theory of animal gravitation, which is what that was originally called, to animal magnetism. Which is in the zeitgeist. You've probably heard that term somewhere before.
I want to say... Well, I've heard of it as, like... I don't want to say derogatory term.
Yes.
Is it?
Okay. Yes. Yes,
okay.
Well, people use it sort of tongue-in-cheek. Like, they're so attracted. They're animal magnetism.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. There we go.
So, in his 1775 revision, he posited that the invisible fluid in the body acted according to the laws of magnetism. And it could be activated by any magnetized objects and manipulated by any trained person. This is going
to go. Please don't manipulate me.
It's going to go off the rails. It's going to go off the rails, dude. So he believed that disease was the result of obstacles, quote unquote, in the fluid's flow through the body. And these obstacles could be broken by things called crises, which were trance states often ending in either delirium or convulsions. You had to, like, break the obstacle, I guess, in order to restore the harmony of the person's fluid flow.
I'm so glad I didn't live back then. Holy shit.
Okay, there's parts of this that you can take and liken to things like the limbic system and all of that. Like, the... there's parts of
this. Maybe it was the beginning.
Maybe. Like, I want to...
Like, try to give the guy credit somewhere.
Yeah. Anyway. So we come to Franzl Osterlein. So she was a 27-year-old female with a quote-unquote convulsive malady. Now, this could be a lot of things back in the day. But as Mesmer writes, she, quote, had the most troublesome symptoms, of which was that the blood rushed to her head and there set up the most cruel toothaches and earaches, followed by delirium, rage, vomiting, and swooning. So it sounds like a really bitchin' sinus infection to me.
Right? Yeah. And I like the rage. I'd be pissed off, too.
Toothaches and earaches and headaches? Oh, my.
Oh, yeah.
Oof. No. So her symptoms were so severe that she moved into his house full-time for care.
Is that an option?
apparently. He used a magnet to disrupt the gravitational tides adversely affecting her.
Adversely.
Adversely, yes. Induced the sensation of a fluid draining rapidly from her body, taking her illness with it. Recovery was complete and virtually instantaneous. Now, we know that this was hypnotic suggestion, and if you think about your disease kind of flowing away and whatnot, there are studies for the healing effects of doing this. So, yes, hypnotic suggestion, your illness is running, especially if some of them are a bit psychosomatic. So, in 1778, he was accused of fraud, and so he left Vienna for Paris. Now, Paris is where things began to really go off the rails for Mr. Mesmer.
Of course, it's Paris.
Mm. So, he began treating patients wearing a long silk gown and sometimes waving a magnetized wand over their heads.
I'm getting Star Trek right now.
Girl, I'm getting like Merlin over here. Sorcerer's Apprentice is my doctor. Patients were captivated by his stare, and it said that they were mesmerized.
Ah.
He began to believe he could transfer his animal magnetism to those with depleted levels through the ether.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, used a magnet as a conduit along with a complex and lengthy sequence of hand gestures and touch known as the Mesmer pass.
So he did the hand jive over
him? with the wand and like, all right, Merlin, sit down. Also believed he could transfer his surplus fluid, animal magnetism fluid.
Please don't.
Into inanimate objects through touch. So.
Now you can bottle and take it to go.
It's funny you should put it that
no.
way.
No.
It's funny you should put it that
Jesus.
Way. So he would magnetize patients' clothes and beds so they could receive the healing fluid every hour of the day.
Oh.
He magnetized trees in his garden and chairs in his practice rooms.
Yes. People hugging the trees?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Hey. Yes. Yes, they were. Oh. Yes, ma'am. And then his pièce de résistance was he invented a baquette, which was a large wooden tub equipped with layers of iron filings kind of in the, like it was double layered, and then in between the two layers were iron filings all through the thing, okay. Right? That he had, saturated with his fluid.
This is disgusting. Sounds like he pissed all over it.
And then he would get empty bottles. He placed an iron rod in the bottles and then put the bottles in the tub. Fill them with water.
Jesus.
And so you person would come over, they would reach in the tub, they would get the water, they drink the water.
Ugh.
Saturated with his
That's nasty.
But it was miraculous because he could treat 20 to 30 patients at a time.
You gotta give him props.
Bargain rate. I'm just saying. Group discount.
Group discount.
They would be selling this shit on Groupon.
Oh, absolutely. And Etsy. And
Etsy.
Oh, my God.
So, he claimed cures for blindness, paralysis, convulsions, hemorrhoids, as well as...
Wait, did you still drink it for the hemorrhoids, or did you splash it on your booty?
I don't know. Okay. If we, like, had a animal magnetism bidet, I guess.
Yoo-hoo!
but as well as hysterical conditions and menstrual difficulties. Now, this is where he kind of bit himself in the foot. So, if a woman became hysterical during treatment, she was removed to a crisis room where he would spend time, sometimes hours, alone with them.
Nope.
Right. So... little sketch.
Little butt.
So this gave rise to rumors of quote-unquote sexual abuse. Whether it was abuse or whether it was consensual, either way, there was stuff going on behind closed doors.
Not okay.
Not okay.
Because some of these women were probably married.
all of them were probably all married. Yeah. These are wealthy women.
Yes. Remember, oh, that's right.
We can't own property. Like, what are you talking about? Like, somebody owned these women.
Jesus Christ.
So, in 1784, King Louis the 16th, and I think it was also because one of his mistresses had also gone to Mesmer. Oh. I think I read that, but don't quote me on that. But anyway, King Louis the 16th appointed a commission to investigate the scientific validity of Mesmer. Yeah. In fact, Benjamin Franklin was even on that committee.
Really?
Yeah, Benjamin Franklin, along with Thomas Jefferson, at various times, we were allies with France. France, you know, helped us win the Revolutionary War. So, you know.
And that kind of what also stuck France in the foot was they kept sending money to us and...
There were a lot of things that stuck France in the foot.
Yeah.
But yes, helping the colonies did not help them.
No.
So, they found that Mesmer was unable to support his scientific claims.
He doesn't have magic spit?
Fluid. often patients were cured by touching objects they thought were magnetized or containing fluid, such as the trees we talked about.
Whole new meaning to tree hugger.
Mm-hmm, when they actually weren't. So it was the suggestion that was healing them. It was not his...
The power of suggestion. That's a thing, man.
What do you think we've been talking about?
I know. I'm reconfirming today's subject.
So he was run out of Paris, and the Mesmerist movement basically declined. He ended up dying in Vienna, kind of. Not in obscurity, but, like, I mean, he still had followers, but it was more low-key.
So he's kind of like a cult leader in a way.
In a way.
Yeah.
One of his students, the Marquis de Passigur, actually became a successful magnetist and was the first person, again, this is all Western medicine, so don't come for me, but was the first person to produce a deep form of hypnosis similar to somnambulism, which is sleepwalking.
Oh.
And then from there, we have Abbé Faria. So, he was an Indo-Portuguese priest in 1813 who conducted hypnosis research in India, you know, where all that shit actually comes from.
Right.
he posed the idea that the power generated was from within instead of magnetism or the power of the hypnotist.
Not the juices of the hypnotist.
he founded the Nancy School of Hypnosis-Centered Psychotherapy, which is a French school that's based on his work. So, believe that hypnosis was a normal phenomenon induced by suggestion.
Yeah, tracks.
It is. The institute was founded by Dr. Oh, God.
Do it.
I practice this. Dr. Ambroise Auguste Leibniz.
Sure was an August.
Auguste. Auguste, sweetheart, save some room for later.
Exactly.
Sorry. He founded the Nancy School based on Abbé Faria's, like, concepts. But he's considered the father of modern hypnotherapy.
Not the Mesmer guy.
Not the Mesmer guy, because that's magnetism and whatnot. But what he was doing was hypnosis.
That's, yeah, no, yeah. That's exactly what he was doing.
He just couldn't see the forest for the trees, as it were. he believed his own press.
Yeah.
And dressed like Merlin. Anyway, whatever. So along comes James Braid. Now, James Braid was a Scottish ophthalmologist and is considered the father of hypnosis, as we know hypnosis now.
Oh.
He named it for the Greek god of sleep, Hypnos.
See, there it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. That one falls in line. Not like the god of not Tylenol.
Jeff the god of biscuits. he was the first to suggest that it was psychological and use it in psychosomatic medicine. So mind over matter type of medicine, which kind of leads people to go, huh, if this is mind over matter and we can convince people that the outside is different from the inside. Again, it's freezing in a 105 degree room, that kind of thing. I wonder what are the practical applications.
Well, look at it the way they test medicines. Like, they'll do where somebody gets a placebo and
double-blind studies.
Yeah, the double-blind studies. And, the if it's a weight loss drug, say, the people in the placebo will still lose weight. And they're like, wow, I must be on it.
Right, because it's the power of suggestion.
Exactly.
Very, very good point.
Why, thank you.
So, and in the early, mid-1800s, we start getting hypnotic anesthesia. So, as we...
Well, I guess it's better than nothing.
Right. So, as we went over before, basically, like, bite on the strap, bitch, and hold on.
Yep.
In 1821, Recamier performed a major operation using hypnosis. And the patient was like, I don't feel anything, whatever.
Holy crap.
In 1834, a British surgeon named John Elliotson, who, by the way, introduced the stethoscope to England, he reported numerous painless surgeries using hypnosis as his anesthesia.
So why don't they keep that going?
We'll get there.
Okay.
In the 1840s and 1850s, James Esdale, who's a Scottish surgeon, performed over 200 minor surgeries and 345 major surgeries using hypnosis.
Damn, he was busy.
Yes. And then, if you remember correctly, sort of the later 1800s, then we get chloroform and ether and all that stuff. But wait, the quacks weren't done with it.
Of
so,
course not.
In the 1800s, hypnosis was widely used in America by the spiritualists. Remember, the spiritualists were your seances, were your life after death, whole big thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The Fox sisters, the clacking, the whole
thing. Yes. Right.
So, widely used in America by spiritualists, healers, who believe that the cure came from the spirit realm. Like you do.
Like you do.
But again, power of suggestion.
Yep.
And, of course, Freud decided to get in on the mix.
Oh, of course.
And used it in his treatment of neurotic disorders. So he said that he was helping them recall disturbing events they had forgotten. Now, I want you to remember that this has been tried. Now, even Freud was like,
Freud?
Meh, this is a little sus.
Yeah, thank you.
So he actually abandoned it for like free association writing and things like that. Just kind of letting your subconscious do its thing.
Okay.
Rather than using hypnosis. He was like,
maybe we should leave that locked away.
Yeah, the man who did enough cocaine to kill Luxembourg thought something was sus. Probably we should have, you know, left that one alone.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the science behind hypnotism real quick. So according to the National Library of Medicine, hypnosis can be seen as, quote, a waking state of awareness or consciousness in which a person's attention is detached from his or her immediate environment and is absorbed by inner experiences such as feelings, cognition, and imagery. So these states are common to people. So if you think about getting lost in a book, or when your lizard brain drives you home, like when you drive, or prayer or meditation, anything where your focus becomes internal, but you can still maintain some awareness of the external world,
like daydreaming.
Kind of.
Okay.
Kind of. But you ever notice, like, well, for me, like, I'll be reading, and then all of a sudden, it's 2 hours later, and I'm like, like, I've learned to set alarms, because I know that the world's going to fall away, and, you know, I'm imagining the world in my head, or whatever, and my lizard brain has, unfortunately, driven home way more times than I'd like to admit. So, hypnosis can also be seen as a meditative state, where suggestions made can facilitate calm, relaxation, and can ease pain and anxiety. Some people can even be taught self-hypnosis to manage stress, cope with life's challenges, and improve their physical and emotional health.
Well, isn't that kind of like meditating?
Yeah, so it's a very fine
line between the two.
So meditation focuses on being present in the moment versus meditation checks in with your whole body and makes you present and makes you, you know, more here and now.
I've never meditated. I can't sit still that long.
But self-hypnosis is a way of getting rid of the physical to the mental to deal with things. So how does it work? How does hypnosis actually work? Well, obviously, there needs to be more work. But here's the running theory. So there are two hemispheres of the brain. Your left and your right.
Yeah.
So the left is the logical, rational, and critical section of your brain. So verbal communication is processed here, and intentional memory is processed here. So I need to remember that I have a doctor's appointment on, you know, Wednesday, whatever.
Okay.
Their left side of your brain is in charge of that. Okay, make sticky note in brain.
I love that.
So the right side of your brain is for emotions, feeling, instinct, and intuition. Memory here is involuntary and state dependent. So it's one of the reasons that memory is so unreliable as far as like witness testimony, because based on your emotional state, it can be more fragmented, it can change, and memory is very open to suggestion. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So memory isn't just a recording of what has happened. You know, there are influences and you'll remember things better sometimes and not sometimes. For instance, if you try to recall a conversation you had with somebody, you can remember the broad strokes a lot of times and maybe like exact sentence here or exact sentence there.
Yeah.
But you can't just, unless you have an eidetic memory, you can't just pop it up, right?
Yeah, and then your husband's like, so what was it about? Nothing.
Right.
You were on the phone for 30 minutes. I don't know.
Right. You'll remember snippets. Yeah. But as far as an entire exact linear recording of something, that is not, that's not how memory works.
No, especially not mine.
Again, unless you have an eidetic memory, and that's a whole other thing. But the right side of your brain processes nonverbal communication. So all the nonverbal cues that you'll get, like somebody could be smiling at you, but like, but it's more so reading the, how you read a room. Like you may not, nobody may be talking, but you know, you walk into a room and you can feel tension in a room and like everybody looks really
solemn.
Yeah. Things like that.
Yeah.
So that's the side of your brain that processes those nonverbal cues. Also communicates with symbols and images and the less concrete things of the world. Okay.
Okay.
It's often seen as our unconscious mind. So the stuff that just kind of
happens.
Right. Again, when you walk into a room and everybody and you're like, oh, a bad vibe. Well, the bad vibe is because, you know, this person is clenched or these muscles are tightened or these facial expressions are going on, but you don't consciously go, wow, that person is squinting their head. And that person, they seem tense. But like you do, but it happens on, you read the room unconsciously. Yeah. You just come in and you're like, oh.
Exactly.
Right. So, so the left is in control mostly during normal interaction. Like, you know, we're sitting here talking. It's a very conscious thing.
So we're lefting it right now?
We're lefting it right now.
Awesome.
So when the right takes over inexplicably, like if your right emotional side just starts taking over your daily functions, that's when you get things like panic attacks.
Oh, no.
And a clinician can use suggestion imagery to chill them out, to calm them down. What they think is happening, they've used PET scans to show that when one side... Okay. Let's go with the misconception of you only use 10% of your brain. That's true, but you use your entire brain, but you only use 10% at any given time.
Oh. So,
what happens is one part has to switch off for one side to switch on. And that's essentially what we're doing here. So when you're hypnotized, the left side of your brain switches off so that the right side can switch on.
It's like powering up and powering down.
Kind of. Or think of it like a power grid that is a little bit too taxed.
We know all about that down here.
Yes, we do. So you can't have everything going all at the same time. Think of it as like rolling blackouts in your head.
And something up there might overheat as well.
Exactly. So you can only do so, your brain can only do so much at one time. So for one part to switch on, another part has to switch off. So they've noticed in hypnosis, through PET scans, basically the left side switches off, the right side switches on. And this is where you are more able to be, again, with imagery and suggestion and things like that. And you don't have the left side of your brain being like, bitch, logically, it is not cold in this room. It is 105 degrees. We're sweating our balls off. What are you doing? But the left side has been shut down.
I do not know why this room stays so hot.
Ma'am. That is why so you don't have that control center, that left side being like, no, the hand is not too heavy to lift. You can lift your hand up, goddammit.
Yeah.
It's off. The right side is on.
That's
so
crazy.
That is how they believe, using like PET scans and imagery, that is what is happening when you're under hypnosis.
So it's kind of a good thing our right sides aren't always...
Yes, lizard brain need not be, always on. No. So they've also found that... hypnotizability is found to be a genetic trait. So it runs more in families. So essentially 10% of the population is highly hypnotizable. So it works on a bell curve. Anybody who's ever been in high school and hoped they curved the exam will know what a bell curve is.
Oh, yeah.
So you have basically 10% of the population that is very hypnotizable. You have 10% of the population that cannot be hypnotized.
Yeah.
And mostly everybody else kind of falls somewhere
in the middle.
Yeah, in on that curve of hypnotizability. So patients are evaluated using a susceptibility scale. So the hypnotherapist finds out experiences that make people feel safe and conjure that imagery. So they'll say, say like the beach is your happy place. They'll have you close your eyes. They'll have you relax. They'll have you remember, you know, what does the salt spray feel like on your skin? What does the sand feel like between your toes? What does the sun feel like?
Like
what
do
the gulls sound
like? Do when I'm getting a massage. I like to envision that I'm sitting on the beach.
Yeah. So you actually may know how to do self-hypnosis. You just don't know. It's that guided imagery.
And I did pass out last time and woke up to my own snoring.
So, and the patient will slip into a state of calming visualization. So once in this state, people are more open to suggestion and are able to detach from past painful experiences and visualize a solution to problems. So you're not, it basically gets you out of your own way.
Gets you out of your own head.
Exactly.
I like that thought process.
Yeah, gets you out of your own way. What do we use this for? Well, hypnotism there's strong evidence for use of hypnotism in management of pain, in management of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, PTSD, and insomnia. There's limited evidence, though evidence there is, management of depression, anxiety, smoking cessation.
I've heard of that.
Post-operative wound healing and weight loss. Hypnotism is actually still used in dental procedures in Scotland.
Well, it's kind of where it's like...
It's kind of its bread and butter.
Yeah.
But people, instead of using like nitrous or drugs or anything like that, people will opt for hypnosis and they have really good outcomes with it. So it has been proven to help reduce post-operative pain in cancer patients.
Aww.
As well as palliative care. So there was a breast cancer trial. They asked women who were going in for a lumpectomy, so taking out a cancerous lump in a woman's breast. They were given the choice between general anesthesia, you know, the gas, you're all the way under, or they could do just local, so they just deaden the area and use hypnosis. So these were the two options that were given. So those who chose the local anesthetic with hypnosis experienced less pre-op anxiety, so they were less nervous before it happened. They required less pain meds during surgery. So even though you're gassed and out, you're still getting pain meds.
Exactly. And they're having to monitor so much.
And they reported less post-op pain, nausea, fatigue, and discomfort than those who did general. So that anesthesia gas has to get out of your system, and there are people who are very sensitive
to it. It's a horrible thing, especially the pain. Oh, and your shoulders when the gas moves up. Like, I've had abdominal surgeries.
Right. So, you know, that nausea you feel is kind of that gas gets out of your system.
Yes.
You don't have any of that. So it's hypothesized, though, also, that those who undergo general anesthesia, while they're not conscious, are actually having an intense stress response. So you're knocked out, but there is part of you that is freaking out still. It's an intense stress response. Like, you can't help yourself. You're out, but
your body is screaming on the inside?
Basically, your stress hormones are going 90 to freaking nothing. You're having surgery. Somebody's cutting into you. And so
the body's natural reaction.
Right. Unfortunately, this can suppress your immune system. Things like high cortisol levels, because cortisol is a steroid. Steroids suppress your immune system, things like that. So that's a little bit tricky when you get to people like cancer patients.
Yeah.
So they've been trying these hypnosis techniques when having to do operations on cancer patients to save their immune system some issues. And they've been having really good success with it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. However, and but... And this is a big but. hypnosis is not a regulated therapy. There are very few actual, like...
registered hypnotherapists?
Well, like, actual training programs that exist.
Oh, okay.
And they're not, like, they're not held to the same standards and whatnot. So you have practitioners who are varying a varying efficacy and training.
As oh, it were. Okay.
Hypnosis is actually banned in 27 states for use in court, relating to recovered memories as people have used it to plant false info. Let me explain. So, recovered memory. Mind you, this is something that caused Freud to jump ship.
Yeah.
Freud, who thinks that scruples are money in Russia. Like, no, no, no.
No, no, no.
So, recovered memory is a subjective experience of recalling a prior traumatic event, such as sexual or physical abuse, that has previously been unavailable to conscious recollection. So, in the 80s and early 90s, there was a huge recovered memory movement in the United States.
Oh.
What set the stage for this? So the 70s saw the rise of the women's movement and people having more open conversations about sexual abuse, either in childhood or rape as an adult. Combine this with the 80s self-help movement, and you have people that are sort of primed for what came next.
Oh.
So therapists began to claim the ability to help patients unearth memories of childhood sexual abuse, assuring that all their problems were somehow linked to repressed trauma. Problems from trust issues to tooth pain and joint pain, people were claiming, came from these repressed memories. They're doctors, of course, they're, you know, that's who you trust. So they claim to understand the mechanism of repression and how to unlock memories without contaminating them. This is what they assured people. The techniques that they used included relaxation exercises, age regression, dream interpretation, psychodrama, sodium amytal, which you might know as the truth serum. It's not actually truth serum. It's not actually truth serum. It just makes you in a more highly suggestible state, like hypnosis. And hypnosis.
All I'm getting is like Harry Potter when they go get Professor Slughorn, and the memory that he gave Dumbledore was an altered one about how he told Voldemort when he was young how to get the Horcruxes. Yes, I'm nerding out. but it wasn't even the right memory. So Harry had to go get the right memory.
Right.
He had altered his memory.
Right.
So yeah, I like Harry Potter.
Okay.
Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not wrong.
Thank you.
These are memories that are filled with. So patients began recovering memories left, right, and center abuse that lasted decades. They were also convinced that the reason they didn't remember them is because they had created multiple personalities to repress those memories.
Yeah, DID is a coping mechanism.
It is, but it's not as... we'll get there.
Okay.
So this led to a rise in multiple personality diagnoses and also gave rise to what they affectionately called in the 80s, the Satanic Panic.
Oh!
So the Satanic Panic was a belief that satanic cults were sexually abusing children, like, left, right, front, and center. It was a thing. Like, I remember all this happening.
I do not.
So DID, Dissociative Identity Disorder, which is what we now call multiple personalities, is actually a fairly rare condition that affects roughly 1% of the population. But in a space of a very short amount of time, over 40,000 people were newly diagnosed with DID. Based on all of this. So, people, well, I must have repressed it because I created this personality and blah, blah, blah. Because how else would I not remember decades of sexual abuse? This is what people were thinking.
Yeah.
There was a book that was written called Michelle Remembers, which was about recovered memories of being held captive in cages filled with snakes and witnessing the butchering of kittens and stillborn babies
by
a cult, and it's a whole thing. She got them all back in recovered memories.
I'd be suing the asshole who brought them back. I know, but still.
You can't bring back something that was never there in the first place.
No!
By 1994, 13% of patients reported who were undergoing some sort of hypnotherapy recovered memory, like people who were seeking out that type of help. 13% of people reported at least one case of recovered ritualistic abuse, including ritual murders, cannibalization, gang rape, and forced pregnancies. So people were going in and having these memories. However, if you lead somebody down, if you are unscrupulous and lead somebody down sort of these paths when they already want to believe something,
yeah,
they will conjure a whole ass memory about yeah. it. It's, people do that.
Oh my God.
So we'll get there, but there was one lady, it's actually associated with something else, but there was one lady who was talking about how, so her mom, this is a memory specialist that was part of a documentary that I'll get to in a second, but so her uncle told her that she was the one who found her mother. Her mother drowned in a pool. So her uncle said that, oh, you're the one who found the body. So she's like, I don't remember that. But over the course of a couple of days, she constructed this whole ass memory. Like, that's what he said. I was the one that found the body. So she constructed this whole ass false memory about going and finding her mom floating and blah, 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 blah. But they called her back later and was like, I'm sorry, it was your aunt, your mom's sister that actually found the body. It wasn't you. But she convinced herself based on somebody told her this. And this is not even hypnosis. This is just suggestion.
I've heard of that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like you'll tell yourself something so many times that you start to actually believe it. You don't know where the line was blurred between reality and not.
Proving that memory is not linear and is more open to suggestion than people actually give it credit for. People think the memories are recording, and it's not. People began to question question these recovered memories because it presented as perfect recall with visceral reactions. So people would like recount minute details of shit that happened 30 years ago, along with vomiting and passing out and blah blah blah. Like it was this visceral thing.
Yeah,
but that's not how memories work.
Yeah,
most people have sort of an overlying fear or panic with sort of hazy memories. You know, this happened to me years ago, or, you know, I had a spider attack me in an outhouse. It was very traumatizing for me. And now I get kind of a panicky feeling when I walk by outhouses, like that kind of thing. Like that's how it normally is.
Yeah. Okay.
But this was regular, out of nowhere. We're like losing our minds. So not how memory works.
No.
So anyone, but anyone that questioned the methods and the memories of the people as they were coming out was accused of aiding the molesters in re-victimizing the women.
Oh, God.
So you couldn't even question them because now we're in witch trial territory.
So now they just believe it as their truth.
Yeah. So if you like stand up for somebody or whatnot, you're obviously also a witch, or maybe you're a molester, or has anybody looked at your family?
Wow.
Yeah, so it went off the rails. So this led to many people confronting abusers and ended up in court with convictions, and families were torn apart. It was a whole thing.
Damn. Yeah.
There was little or no evidence or studies done about recovered memories before it became widespread. Like, this had already taken off before somebody's like, possible we should, like,
look into this?
Do a study. I don't know. Something. Right.
Jesus.
So, the first trial to use recovered memory was in 1989. And a woman named Eileen Franklin recovered a memory of her father, George Franklin, raping and killing her 8-year-old friend, Susan Nason, 20 years prior.
Holy shit.
And everybody was like, she recalled all these details and crime scene stuff that she couldn't have possibly known, and testified in court and was very emotional.
Believable.
Very believable. So there's a docuseries on Paramount Plus, but it's Showtime, but you can get it if you have Paramount Plus, called Buried. It kind of goes over all of this, which I found after I'd already researched it. But I did watch it. It was interesting.
But she believed it was her truth. So.
She believed it. Like, she believed this happened. So she also claimed that she had recovered memories of sexual and physical abuse at the hands of her father that corroborated by her sister, Janice. Here's the problem. So by 1989, the Supreme Court had already ruled that that memories that were recovered during hypnosis were not admissible in court.
Okay.
So she told them that this memory surfaced organically. She said that she was in her home and her daughter was playing kind of on the ground and looked up at her and she looked so much like Susan, this memory flooded back to her, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's how she presented it in court, because she knew it wouldn't be admissible if it was
a hypnotic
under
one.
Hypnosis.
Yeah.
So they arrested her father and there was a trial, and her father was not a good human.
Oh, so he deserved it anyways.
I mean, I can't say that I'm not judge, jury, executioner, but he was not a good man. So when they searched his apartment trying to look for evidence, maybe that he kept of all this stuff.
Trophy.
Right. So they found some pretty extreme porn related to incest, pedophilia, bestiality.
Oh, my God.
So past girlfriends and prostitutes.
So he needed to go away anyway.
Yeah, had solicited, like, hey, I'm going to hire you, but can you bring your daughter over? That's what I really want. Like, things like that. Like, not a good dude.
Yeah.
With all this in mind, so he was convicted of first-degree murder in November of 1990. But it was based on this testimony kind of alone. So people are like, how could she remember these crime scene details? Everything she remembered had actually been in the news. They'd been in various articles. Her husband, Barry, had actually kept a scrapbook.
Why?
I fucking know. That whole dynamic is weird. But had kept a scrapbook of the killing, and it was stored in her office. So she had at her fingertips, like, all the articles. So everything she was talking about, the details, they were common knowledge. There wasn't anything that was not...
Not like the she knew a detail that the police hadn't released. Correct. Type of thing.
Which... So, and everybody knew about that, but the judge did not let the defense kind of go, hey, no, everything she said is like that. No.
Everybody knows that.
This is public knowledge.
Yeah.
The judge wouldn't let the defense say that in court. So,
God.
So the jury was like, she knows all these details. Whoa. Right. Yeah. Like, holy shit. This dude didn't help himself either. He sat in the court and was like smirking every once in a while. And he's fucking creepy. All the siblings, by the way, I mean, talked about what an abusive human this was.
They didn't overturn his conviction, did they?
We'll get there. So he was a very abusive human, physically, emotionally. The sexual part, that's given to interpretation. But he did just beat the living shit out of these kids. He was a horrible, and he was an alcoholic. He's a horrible human. But, and more than likely he did sexually abuse him because that's where his leanings were. But, so he was sentenced to life in prison. In 1995, a circuit court judge overturned the conviction based on trial errors, including the prosecution's argument, that by refusing to respond to accusations of guilt, he had in essence confessed. That is not how this shit works.
What?
That is not how this shit works. And then the judge not letting in the trial stuff and blah. Yeah. He was convicted because he's a bad dude, not because he murdered somebody.
Yeah.
His case was overturned. He was exonerated. So Eileen comes back. Mind you, Eileen has now gone on and she's doing Oprah. She's doing all the interviews.
Oh, yeah. Ricky Lay. Yeah. Geraldo.
Comes out she's been a prostitute. Like, it's a whole thing. Oh, Jesus. Like, oh, God. Just the docuseries. It's so chef's kiss. It's so good.
Watching that.
Yeah. Eileen went on to accuse her father of two more rape murders that she had witnessed. So she said that she witnessed the Susan... The murder of her 8-year-old friend, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, she had just been brought along with him. And now there's two more rape murders. Like, I don't understand father-daughter field trip being rape murder, but, like, I'm very confused.
I mean, my dad and I went to the zoo. I don't know what the hell these two are doing.
But apparently it was a thing. Like, and I witnessed him do this. Oh, and I witnessed him do that. And, like, it's what?
So why didn't you ever say anything?
Because she repressed the memory.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And she was just getting all these memories back. So
did it hurt?
So witnessed two more rape murders. So they collected DNA from her dad. It didn't match the rape kits that were done on these women that she had accused him of killing. In fact, in 2018, they actually caught the reel. There were like five women that this dude like raped and murdered. Ronnie Lynn Halbauer, was finally caught in 2018.
I do love that these people who thought they would literally get away with murder, like, as forensics is developing. Right. Like, you screwed now, motherfucker!
Right. But this trial was important because it set off a chain reaction.
Oh, I can imagine.
Of repressed memory trials where, he was convicted on her testimony. Like, that's it. There was no physical evidence.
Yeah.
Just that. And things went off the rails. There were thousands upon thousands of court cases now that were being based on repressed memories and things like that. God. It was crazy. By 1995, it was proven that one could plant false memories, and it's even easier if you believe it's possible, like what I was talking about before. If you believe something, like, I honestly think that I was molested, but I just can't remember it. You know, if you put your under hypnosis and you ask the right leading questions, you construct a memory. They prove that, not with things like molestation. They did it with more innocuous type things. Yeah. But so evidence has also shown that there is no special memory mechanism responsible for forgetting trauma. Like, you don't have a little walled section that you can be like, you go over there. We're just going to let you
tuck you away.
No. So that's not a thing. But one of the things that did come out of this, one of the only, I guess, good litigious things that came out of this. So people were accusing their former molesters, but they were accusing them of murder and all these other crimes. Because the statute of limitations at this time on molestation and rape was 3 years. Ugh. So somebody who was molested when they were, say, 8 gets to be 19 and finally, you know, has the courage, the autonomy.
The knowledge.
The courage, the autonomy, the, like, I'm out of the house finally. Yes, they did this to me. There was no recourse for these people.
That is awful.
Who, you know, it actually happened to, like, this wasn't a, I have a repressed memory. No, like, this fucking happened. There was no recourse. So the courts actually began to allow civil suits for molestation cases and rape cases that were older than 3 years.
Oh, good.
So that it's not a criminal case, but it is a civil case, and there is some sort of recourse as far
Bring
as that goes.
Some sort of justice, right. At least.
Now, mind you, you couldn't use that if hypnosis was involved, but there was that. And that is what I have on hypnosis. Do I believe hypnosis works. I've been hypnotized. I get it. Do I think it is the uber all-powerful? Absolutely not. Do I think it's a really good tool to deal with things? Again, as somebody who... So I call it tuning out pain or tuning out, you know, anxiety or, you know, putting my brain in a different place is what I call it.
Yeah.
But really, it is me going through steps to... It's just a tool in my toolbox to deal with pain and stress and things like that.
Yeah.
And that's, it's not an end all be all. It's just another tool in the toolkit.
I gotcha. I don't know. I think I'm going to put it right there with ghosts. I've never seen it. It's never happened to me. So, but that doesn't mean I can deny that it's true.
Yeah.
But.
You're agnostic on the point of hypnosis.
I am. I'm agnostic on hypnosis and ghosts.
Yes. And that's fine. Like I said, it is, you know, if you walk in, you know, I've seen people go, you can't hypnotize me and blah, blah, blah. Well, no, of course I can't now. Honestly, because it is all about susceptibility.
Yeah.
You go, absolutely not. You're not fucking doing this. Well, no, it's...
You just set up a roadblock in
your head. Yeah, I can't. It's all about the power of suggestion, guys. Like... Of course, you're not going to get a pass now. It's kind of the point. So, but yeah, that is my take on hypnosis. I have presented you, dear oddlings, with the information. Do with it as you will.
Sorry, we've been gone for a hot minute, but you know what? We're two moms. We're busy. We got jobs.
Again, y'all don't pay my bills.
I just got another job. I have 4 jobs now.
I have one.
You have one very long job.
I have one very long job. I was on call 13 days last month. I tired. Anyway, so, but in the meantime, if you guys would like to get in touch with us, Chrissy, take it away.
All right. Let me stretch.
I'm going to dust this off. Come on, go.
I know, right? Holy crap. So we are at oddlymedical@gmail.com, oddlymedical.com. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're kind of on Snapchat. And we have...
Snapchat? You mean TikTok.
Oh, TikTok. Whatever the hell the kids are using these days.
Whatever the kids are using.
Snappers. And we do have a video on YouTube.
We have... Three or four.
Oh, we have multiple.
We have several many.
Do we really?
Yes, dear.
Damn, I'm behind.
Yes, dear.
Okay, dear. I will watch those. So, yeah, we're fabulous. We're fantastic. And, well, we're odd and she's medical. So, you know, there's that. Does that make me the odd and you're the medical?
I kind of think I have odd, too.
You do have odd, too. I do not have medical other than anomaly. So, there's that. We hope you've enjoyed this week on... Hypnotism. If you've been hypnotized, hold on. here's the thing. If you've been hypnotized and you have any kind of story to go with it, email us. I want to hear.
I know. I do, too.
I want to know. Like,
I always want y'all's opinions on things. Yeah. Like, I've been trying to... Look at me. Look what I can do.
Questions, comments, concerns? Definitely reach out to us on one of our platforms, especially email, like oddlymedical@gmail.com.
We need to go.
We do. All right. Y'all are awesome.
I'm sweating.
I'm rambling.
Yes, that is fine. So until next time, beautiful, intrepid, loyal oddlings, I'm Sarah.
I'm Chrissy.
And
bye.